All right, so we're working our way through Genesis, and today we come to the end of, for this year, for this whole fall, we've just done Genesis 1 and 2. Obviously, we won't stay at this pace. We'll have to pick it up a bit. But, you know, we're setting the foundation. Now we're talking about marriage, the first marriage. So let me read you the passage, two passages. Then man said, the man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. That is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame." And then Paul, looking back on this passage, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church." And so that first marriage becomes the prime picture of the gospel, of Christ united himself to his bride, the church. So just a bit of review. Adam needed a partner both for communion as well as to fulfill the dominion mandate. And the animals were not satisfactory for either, obviously. And so Eve is created, and they are told together, we saw that in chapter 1, to take dominion. Now, we talked about roles. They're not given specific roles. They are to use what they do, however they do it, for some obvious ones who would have the babies. They are to use their gifts and skills to work together to subdue the earth, is all we're given. And the reason I bring up roles is I want to give you a modern day example why you have to have this worked out. Because there is a growing phenomenon in the church called stay-at-home dads. And depending on your view of roles is how you're going to deal with this pastorally. I have a friend who's a stay-at-home dad. He's in the PCA. His wife is very skilled in the tech industry, and so she's always worked. He is homeschooled and raised the kids at home. And that's what he does. He just hasn't worked he hasn't had a job. And I think he's on his fourth child now. And in the churches he's been in, there's been a lot of criticism, raised eyebrows. And there are a number of people who believe that if we're assigned roles, gender roles, and that's the role of the wife. It's not the role of the husband. The role of the husband assigned by God is to work and provide financially. The role of the wife is to stay home and raise the children. But now you've got this growing movement of stay-at-home dads, and that's in the church. So pastorally, how do you deal with it? Well, you have to have some theology of what's in the Bible and what's free to do according to what's best for your own family. So traditionally, they're going against the traditional roles, but are they going against the Bible? Has the Bible set it up so that's considered sinful? And there are many in the church who say yes. And so he's had a hard time. And what are we going to do? This is growing because some women just, they're so skilled that if they're going to make money and provide for their children, it's the wife who is the one skilled to do that. Now, he doesn't mind. He doesn't mind staying home. It would drive me nuts, but he doesn't mind. You know, it fits them. Does anyone know Christian stay-at-home dads? Raise your hand if you know them. Yeah. So what do you think of that happening? If it works. Harold, what did you say, Harold? You're envious? I don't know. TJ, it would have been a disaster, right? If I had done that.
Yes. It's a certain personality.
They'd all be homeless by the time they're 8. Go ahead. So you can see how sometimes even our theology of Genesis has a very practical consequence. What do you do? If it's in your church, do you instruct him this is wrong? that you're not fulfilling God's required role? Or do you see it as they're both to do what they can do best to fulfill their responsibilities to raise their children? So that's an example where it matters. And if you've talked to people who are stay-at-home dads, they have a tough time in conservative churches. Have you talked to them? They don't quite, once they tell someone, what do you do for a living? I'm the homemaker. You know, they look upon you with suspicion, don't they? All right. So questions about our passage. Last time we looked at the way it's described how Adam and Eve were made. Now we're looking at these questions on how this union is described, or this first marriage. The first question is, who is Adam speaking to in verse 23? Notice how the man says, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. He doesn't look at Eve and say, you are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. So he's not speaking to Eve, then who's he speaking to? Well, he's speaking to God. So this is really the first marriage vow ever. What Adam is doing is turning to God and saying, this is now. In a sense, he's making a vow that she is my partner. She is bone of my bone. We will be unified. We will love. I will love her. And so he's speaking to God, and that becomes a very beautiful vow that he makes to God. And that's why it's in the third person. The next question is, why does Adam name Eve? Which is a little bit somewhere else, but, well, he called her woman. Some say this proves he has authority over her, because to name someone means you have authority. For example, Adam named the animals. That's awesome. Often assume that means he has authority over the animals. But mostly in the Bible, when someone's named, it has nothing to do with authority. And we want to be very careful with that, because Hagar names God in Genesis. She says, now I will call you this. And she has a new name for God. We don't want to say that means Hagar has authority over God, right? So typically in the Bible, when a name is given, it's establishing a new relationship. That's normally the way names are given. And so you were Simon, now you are Peter, right? You're given a new name as a new aspect of a relationship is formed. Sarai to Sarah, Abram to Abraham. God establishes a new step in the relationship. Now you have a new name. And so this is much more personal by naming her. It's more about the relationship, that now he's found a bride for Adam. So it is much more beautiful. Adam is not getting a new pet, a new slave. He's getting a wife. And so the naming is a relationship. Now that brings us to the next question. Why does Moses write that in marriage a man leaves his father and mother? Historically, this is really odd, isn't it? Because historically, who does the leaving? The wife, the woman leaves for the husband. So why is it the opposite here? Why does the man leave the father and mother and not the woman leave her father and mother? Because that's actually how it more happened.
Man is stupid.
I must have missed that there.
We need our minds to help us grow up.
But also notice, look back up at the passage. It says, that is why a man leaves his father and mother. Now, Moses is writing this as an editorial comment, because Adam obviously didn't leave his father and mother. So Moses is looking back and saying, this is why, from this point on, men would leave their father and mother. So what is Moses doing? So when When Adam says, now you are bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, Moses, as an editorial aside, says, this is why men leave their father and mother, and they cling to their wife. Well, it's helpful. The word clinging in the Old Testament is often used to leave idols and cling to the Lord. There's a separation from something formally to be committed to something new. And so the idea is the man no longer serves his parents and their chief interests. Now he does what? His wife's chief interests is what he's there to do. He's there no longer to please his parents, but to please his wife is the idea. Go ahead. Yeah, and Deuteronomy 24:5, as you see here in the text, really brings this out, this idea. This is a fascinating verse. Remember, this is a utterly patriarchal society where women are the property of their husbands. They're looked upon as property. If a man has recently married, he must not be sent to war or have any other duty laid on him. For 1 year, he is to be free to stay at home and bring happiness to the wife he has married. Think about what a revolutionary law this is in that world. So you're a soldier. You're part of the army. And you want to fight. And the law says if you get married, you can't go fight. For the first year, you owe your wife a year at least of bringing her happiness. See, that's a commentary on what Moses is saying. You leave the commitment of serving your parents. Now you bring your wife happiness. That's a good way to think about what's a good wife or husband. Well, is your wife happier that you're around her? Is your husband happier that you're around her? Or are they miserable because you're around them? Marriage brings happiness to the other party. And so it doesn't mean geographically you leave your, it doesn't mean you have to move out of your parents' home. That may be your home. But priority-wise, as Randy said, your commitment now, your purpose is the happiness of the wife. Now, that has a lot of practical implications, doesn't it, for in-law tensions. You know, it's when you look at the reasons given for divorce, up there in the top five is in-law tensions and problems with extended family. So you have a father and mother who still want to be over-involved in the marriage. And then you have tension with the wife saying, you know, your mother says to the husband, your mother is overbearing and doing this that is hurting our relationship. The man is to prioritize his wife over his parents, is the point. He leaves the commitment of pleasing his parents first to pleasing his wife first. So now she takes priority. So you have to, then the husband's responsibility is to say to his parents, you need to very politely back off from our marriage. Our marriage is now the priority. And that's the way God intended it from the beginning. Now, I don't have exact advice how you say this to parents, but your wife is the priority, husbands, and your husband is the priority over parents once you're married. If that means they have to stop butting in, if that means they have to stop putting pressure or not respecting boundaries, the marriage is the priority. Now, that happens all the time, right? That seems like a constant issue with marriage. Any thoughts, experiences, counseling on that? Why would authority be a part? I don't understand the point. But the husband didn't have authority over his parents, so it's not saying you used to have authority over your parents, now you have authority over your wife. Well, it's one of those things that you have to be careful that everything said to one party doesn't mean exclusively it doesn't belong to the other. That's just not true in biblical interpretation. So, for example, in 1 Timothy, if a woman is told not to dress in a way to show off at church. It doesn't mean men can dress in a way to show off in church. There's still application, but he's dealing with what may be more common or more of an issue. So it doesn't mean a wife, once she marries, is more committed to her parents than her husband. So if you want to say there's a leadership in love, and yeah, that's fine. But that's, you're looking at headship as leading in love in a sense, not in authority. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you have to remember in that culture that the husband had all the power. And so his family would have much more say. It's his family that sort of now, if it's a clan, you know, has the say, owns everything. She didn't have rights in that sense. So it is a reminder to the husbands, she is your priority now. She's not simply a servant in your greater clan. But it's a very beautiful picture. When you think about the importance of this happiness. You know, you're being invaded by the Philistines and you're a soldier and you've been married 3 months and you say, I want to go fight for Israel. And the law says, no, you have to stay home and make sure your wife is happy. Think how any other nation looking at that would say, what in the world is this law? It's only the Mosaic law that has this, which really makes it beautiful, doesn't it? All right, number four, what is the mystery of marriage in Ephesians 5? Marriage is not the mystery. You may think it's the mystery, but marriage is not the mystery. What marriage pictures is the mystery. So when Paul says this is a mystery, he's not saying marriage is a mystery. He's saying marriage points to something that is a mystery. And so when a husband and wife now cling to each other and they love each other in their unity, they've become one flesh, that picture is a mystery. And that mystery is Christ's unity, his love for his church, that he has married himself to a bride and they've become one flesh. Not in any gruesome, weird physical way, but in a spiritual union between us and our Savior. That's the mystery. It's interesting, in Ephesians 5, Paul can only talk about marriage a bit, and he goes to something greater. He doesn't spend a lot of time on marriage, but he spends a lot of time on Christ's love for his church and the church's love for Christ. And why that's so important is, that, therefore, the unmarried in church, marriage teaches them as much as it teaches those of us who are married. Because it points to the reality that we all have, which is a relationship with Christ. And so sometimes divorced, single, unmarried feel like second-class citizens in the church because we talk about marriage so much. And they're thinking, okay, I don't have it. And I don't know if I'm going to have it. And so they feel sort of out of it. But Paul won't stay on marriage itself very long. He goes to the reality, the eternal reality of what we all have. This is but a picture. But we have the reality, the eternal reality, whether you're married or not. So sometimes talking too much about marriage itself, the institution in this life, tends to do damage in the church to those who aren't married. Because it just seems like, so what's for me? Marriage seems to be the ideal, what God wants, but I'm not married. Or I had a bad marriage and I don't want to get married. But Paul will always bring it, oh, this is just a picture. Let me tell you about the mystery that's the reality. So have you experienced this before where marriage is so emphasized that those who aren't married feel sort of out of it in the church? What, any experience? What? Yeah, if the example is exalted, then we're in trouble. Yeah. other examples of where, if you're not married, you're sort of feeling in the church a little bit out of it. Yes, Conrad.
I am 15 years old.
We do not expect you to be married. Yeah, I've heard a lot of 6-week series on marriage, but not on being single. Right? Yes. Oh, you're talking about the verse up in Bone of My Bone, that they're given a responsibility together. Right. And just to be clear, Ken, on that, it's not accurate to say that there's no differences between men and women, obviously, in the Bible. But it's what is stated in Genesis, our roles given. Some would be so obvious they don't have to be stated. You know, God didn't have to say, now you woman, you'll have the babies. Men, you won't have the babies. I mean, we knew. But when we say roles, we mean, you know, that you can do this the best of your ability with what your strength is. So men are usually providers because they're stronger, right? Normally. But that's not required. There may be cases where he can't do that. So, but there's obviously differences in every way, not just physically, but just men and women are different. No, headship in Ephesians 5, as we said, focuses on the unity between the head and body. And so it's not a role. It's the man loving his wife like Christ loved the church. So it's a headship of love. Yes. Right. But you also have to remember culturally why Paul may address one gender over the other. Because culturally, it was the husband who already had supreme authority over his wife in the Greek world. And so that was a given. To say husbands be in charge of your wives would have been such an obvious thing. All husbands were in charge of their wives. That was the culture. But in that culture, to tell a husband, love your wife sacrificially, would have been very different, very revolutionary, very only Christian. And so you didn't have to tell wives to do what all wives were expected to do, simply obey and serve their husband. That was the culture. But to have respect for your husband and to defer in a loving way, both of these are very Christian. So in all, the same thing with 1 Timothy 2, you have to look at the culture of why Paul would need to address certain ways. That helps. But I want to go to this point before we close, and that is that the marriage in Genesis is the supreme example. Adam and Eve is the example more than any of our marriages of Christ in the church. Paul quotes Genesis. And so think of it that they look at one another and they have no shame. Have you ever experienced a life of no shame? And so the ideal is Adam and Eve before the fall. It's a perfect, unsullied relationship. No shame, living in harmony. Something that we as fallen creatures, even as Christians, never really attain to in that sense in this life. That's kind of Pat's point. So the idea, and I want to quote Gordon Hugenberger. Gordon Hugenberger taught at Gordon Conwell with Klein. They were friends, and I really appreciate his work. But it says, thus we see that only the glorious marriage of unsullied Adam and Eve could be an appropriate antitype to the supreme prototype of the union of the Redeemer, God incarnate, with his elect people. And why that's important, here's another practical reason. Is you have a marriage that's full of abuse, hatred, either one person against the other, and by the way, it's growing where women are abusing their husbands. That seems to be growing in our culture too. So it's both ways. And then if there's any type of, I can't do this anymore, I need to leave, the church says, yeah, but that won't picture Christ's relationship with the church. See the problem? I don't think abuse pictures Christ's relationship with the church. I don't think hatred. The picture is the ideal picture of Adam and Eve loving, not the legal document that's called marriage. So two people where there's continued abuse and hatred, you're not picturing Christ in the church here. You're doing the opposite. You know, I've never met a child of parents that couldn't get along say, yeah, the worst part about the divorce, I no longer had that great example of Christ in the church. Nobody says that. And so marriage in itself as a legal entity doesn't picture Christ in the church. The love in a marriage of the husband and wife loving each other, that pictures Christ in the church. And that's the point of going back to Adam and Eve. It's him looking at her and making a vow. You are now bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Now they're partners together to subdue the earth. That pictures Christ in the church. It pictures that kind of unity. So be careful of using marriage in a way that really hurts people to put on a guilt trip. Well, if you don't stay together, you'll no longer picture Christ in the church. I think that train, you know, left the tracks years ago. Yes. So any thoughts on more on the first marriage? Think what I want you to see, that not only is it a beautiful picture, but in the ancient Near East, this type of thing was unheard of, with women being pretty much purchased as property. I mean, it's only one aspect of the bigger picture of divorce, but it forces us not to use the guilt trip, that legal document not being changed is what preserves the picture. This is just not the point. And that's actually a Roman Catholic view. It's not a Protestant view traditionally. The Roman Catholics taught from Augustine on that marriage was a sacrament. It so pictured Christ in the church that you can't get divorced or you destroy the picture. And so couples kind of stayed together, legally married, but weren't really together. And Protestants now, they've sort of taken on the Catholic view. Yeah, Adam and Eve is definitely the example of marriage. But it's the example of Christ more than anything else. When you look at the Old Testament, there are no good marriages in the Old Testament. Did you know that? There are not one. We seem to see a little bit in the New Testament, but we weren't told nothing about them, like Aquila and Priscilla. We know they did ministry together and did things, but we don't know anything about them. But you think of all the marriages from the time of the fall, kind of messed up. Abraham and Sarah, you know, Jacob's problems, David and his wives. Not a lot of great examples in the Old Testament from there. Yeah. Yeah. And where this helps practically, one area, and we'll close, just people will come to you, your friends, Christian friends, family, and they'll talk about problems with parents and in-laws of hurting the relationship. You can go right here to Genesis and Deuteronomy. And so God has a priority for marriage, that there is a leaving and cleaving principle. And you can use that to say, now, practically, how does this work out? But it means that your chief purpose now is to, you know, help and bring happiness to your spouse, not your parents. Or you could buy the book Boundaries and give that out. That seems to be the thing nowadays. Have you read Boundaries? Yes, Jonathan. To fulfill the responsibility together to subdue the earth. God is mostly called a helper throughout the Bible. So it doesn't mean that she's his servant in this task. She helps him, just like Israel helped. I mean, God helped Israel. It's the same word in the Hebrew. All right. Let's pray.